Good evening. It is 5 p.m. on Thursday, February 26th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents, now in a new time slot. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be diving into the kickoff of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, the city's purchase of the Lemoyne Point Farm property after years of legal limbo, an update from City Council's last meeting, and the Coldest Night of the Year fundraiser coming up this weekend in support of Lionhearts. Without further delay, let's get into our first story. After a highly anticipated court ruling last week, the City of Kingston is moving forward with the purchase of the property at 2000 Front Road, known to many as Lemoyne Point Farm. The acquisition follows a court-approved settlement reached after years of confidential negotiations related to the property. The city purchased the approximately 80-acre site for $12 million. Jim Biaggi, Chris Cannon, Sheila Mirsky, and Richard Rayburn Gibson of the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, a coalition of Kingston residents who have long advocated for the protection of the land, sat down with CFRC to share their history with the property and their thoughts on this latest development.
Jim Biaggi, and I'm with the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group, which I've been with since its inception.
So I'm Chris Cannon, and there were seven of us who got together right after Mary Fraser died, realizing that the Lemoyne Point Farm might be under pressure of development, and we formed the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group and have since evolved. But Sheila and I had a long history back 35, 36 years ago, of back when Lemoyne Point Farm was in Kingston Township. There was pressure to develop 22, 23 acres corner of the farm and build houses and extend sewers, et cetera, et cetera. And we long fought that. Sheila was the head of our Protect Lemoyne Point organization that formed. And I should turn it over to Sheila, but just to say that we would attract 500 people at public meetings in township offices to protect Lemoyne Point from this development.
Hi, I'm Sheila Mirsky. Yes. So I was one of many people who have been involved with trying to protect Lemoyne Point Farm for, 36 years. It was really heartwarming to see how much the communities wanted that land protected. I mean, back before the internet and before email and all that technology, we were able to get together a petition with 6,000 signatures to present to the then Township Council of Kingston. And we influenced a municipal election result, actually, to keep that development from occurring way back then. So it was a long-standing desire of the community to see that land not turn into a subdivision and to have it remain natural. And ultimately, we were hoping that there could be a public purchase.
Almost an original member of the group, and been with them since that same period of time, 2022. And as you know from our website and your previous research, our goal to conserve the field, forest, and shoreline of Lemoyne Point Farm for future generations. The group that Chris mentioned and others have mentioned that it includes seven people is a really spectacular group of talented people that have been doing advocacy work to protect this property.
Thank you all for that background. And again, there's a long history here. After all these years of discussion and advocacy, what does this ruling feel like?
Well, we really think it is good news, and we applaud the city for their persistence in negotiating this purchase of the farm. They've been involved in this for quite some time, and we've been in contact with them. With the politicians, the mayor's office, councilors, senior staff, legal department, for a couple of years as these negotiations have been underway. So it is a remarkable and important milestone that they have finalized the negotiation of this process through the hearing process and so on. And it's an important investment in one of the few remaining natural spaces within the urban boundary of Kingston. And Chris has already talked about how this is you know, so important in terms of preserving this special place, this jewel on Lake Ontario. You know, we're pleased with this step, but you know, we're going to be vigilant in the future to make sure that, you know, our objectives and our objectives in terms of the local and regional community are met.
I'll just echo Richard, and we've worked long and hard, and me and Sheila for 36 years to make sure that it remained an open natural space with public access, and this is a step towards that.
Really, really over the moon that this purchase has happened, and we can now work positively with the community and the city to see that it's properly protected in the long term.
Looking ahead, according to a statement released by the city, the land will remain open to the public and protected while long-term plans are developed with community input. More detailed information is expected to be included in a council report scheduled for March 24th, 2026. The Save Le Moyne Point Farm Group says they plan to continue their advocacy and remain vigilant to ensure the farm's long-term protection.
Yeah, I think we're most concerned about what the process will be to ensure that this this property does remain protected in the long term. As you know, councils change every 4 years, and the future council could easily decide to rezone and sell off part of that property. So that's why I think Richard mentioned that we need to remain engaged and vigilant. But I'm confident that the community is so much in favor of having that remain natural space that I don't think that there's going to be that will ever happen. But we want to not have to remain on guard all the time and see if we can put in place something that will ensure that that could not happen.
Just one more layer on that as well is that Mary Fraser, who was the owner of the farm at the time she died, had long wanted the farm to be public space and not be developed, and had those expressed as wishes in her last will and testament. So I feel we honoring Mary's wishes as well if we are endeavoring to keep it a natural space and keep it on farm and the forests from development.
And moving forward, what kinds of safeguards are you maybe hoping get put in place? Like you guys said, we're almost at the end of this council term. There's going to be lots of changeover in the future. What are some of the measures that you think should be put in place to keep this space safe?
You know, we have looked at legal techniques in the past. One scenario that we've looked at was conservation easements, and this is where you put a registered on title document on file that limits future use, and there could be specifications in that conservation easement. As Sheila says, local councils change, and you know, 10 years might sound like a long time, not to worry, but we're thinking about generations from now and having this place remain a natural area, and protected, these fields and these forests and this unique, very unique shoreline, not until 2040, but you know, beyond the turn of the century and so on. So to have a robust system in place that can be resilient against the puts and takes of politics and economics and everything else needs some protections in place that might be legal documents or other things.
And we must remember the Indigenous practice of always looking 7 generations ahead as you plan. I hope we will continue to do that.
The city has also indicated it will pursue partnerships with organizations such as the Cataraqui Region Conservation Authority and other not-for-profit groups. In the city's statement, Mayor Brian Patterson said these partnerships will help ensure the property remains a welcoming and sustainable space, adding that the city looks forward to working with residents to imagine the future of Le Moyne Point Farm.
I think when we talk about how unique and magnificent this gem of a property is. I think the word imagine is really important. This is a once in a lifetime opportunity, a generational opportunity to save this property and dream and imagine about a future in which this type of property exists decades and longer from now. So I may be sounding a little altruistic here, but to encourage Kingstonians and others to imagine that that future is something I'd like to see out of the consultation.
Thanks, Richard. That's a very positive way of putting it, and I agree. And we had a community meeting. When was that? 2 years ago, I guess, where there was a visioning exercise of how, for people to imagine how the property might be used in public space. And that information's on our website. But I think for the city to undertake something like that, that would get people's minds churning about what might be done with the space would be wonderful.
As Kingston begins to imagine what comes next for the farm, the Save Lemoyne Point Farm Group says they will continue their work, also pointing to the importance of the upcoming municipal elections as a key moment for advocacy and accountability.
The broader agenda of vigilance and looking at approaches to ensure long-term preservation, but drilling down a little bit, it might be to participate in a consultation that might be happening that the city runs. We will continue to be in contact with our broad base of supporters across Kingston and maybe seek additional advice from them. We are working with an organization called Small Change Fund, and through that have had the ability to receive charitable donations. So we have some funds, and if there's opportunities to hire subject matter experts or others to support the community's work on the future of the farm, we can do that. We'll certainly continue to be active with our newsletter and on social media, keeping people informed. And I think also, we have met, as I said, with politicians and senior staff at the city. We will continue to do that, make sure they're aware of our vision for this property. And, it won't be too many months before we might decide we want to pay attention to who's running for municipal council and mayor and see what they're saying about their agenda.
Just to add to what Richard said about reaching out to our local politicians with the elections expected in November and uncertainty around mayoral candidates. At the previous election cycle, we were quite successful reaching out to mayor and councillors from almost all of those people, getting commitments that the farm should be protected from development. So we are likely to be engaging in a campaign during the summer and fall to get commitments again from people running again for councillor and mayor's positions.
Before we get into more local news this evening, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, February 26th, daytime high of -1, and there is a 60% chance of precipitation. Will vary between snow or rain depending on the time of day and the daytime high, overnight dropping down to -6. Friday, February 27th, daytime high of 3 degrees, dropping to 0 overnight, cloudy all day. Saturday, February 28th, warmest day of the week, daytime high of 5 degrees with cloudy conditions, dropping back down to -9 overnight. Sunday, March 1st, daytime high of -4 with a mix of sun and cloud. And then Monday, March 2nd, looks like we will have more winter weather in store. Daytime high of -8 with a 75% chance of snow flurries in the forecast. This is your City of Kingston traffic report. Just a reminder, overnight parking restrictions are in effect for the rest of February. Come March 1st, the overnight restrictions will loosen to where overnight parking is only banned when weather conditions require it, i.e. if there is snow or freezing rain in the forecast. Until March 1st, all overnight street parking is banned in the City of Kingston.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. The Kingston Canadian Film Festival is back for another year, with the 2026 edition kicking off last night and running until March 1st. In its 26th year, the Kingston Canadian Film Festival is the largest festival in the world dedicated exclusively to Canadian film. Festival director Mark Garnes sat down with CFRC to chat about the return after last year's big anniversary, what's new this year, and celebrating Canadian content in 2026. We talked a lot in 2025 about how the festival continues to grow. What's new about this edition?
Yeah, it's hard to talk. That's kind of what we were thinking all year. Like, how can we top our 2025 edition, which was our 25th anniversary? And we felt it was a really good one. I think we set box office records, and it felt like last year really felt like the first full year back after the pandemic. I know we're not even really talking about that anymore, but, like, you know, a lot of arts organizations definitely took a hit through and after the pandemic. And so last year really felt like we were back to where we were in 2019, and we even exceeded that a little bit. And then so far for 2026, we're on track, similar to what we were last year as well, or maybe even a little bit better. So yeah, I kind of feel like the festival's back in the way it was meant to be experienced and on the trajectory that we were on pre-pandemic. And, you know, we're an all-Canadian film festival, so I think sometimes people are kind of like fishing for a theme with the festival. And the nice thing about our festival is it's really just baked into our mission. Like, we show the best all-Canadian films of the year, so that's what people are gonna get again this year. And then all the usual extras that we have, like music and comedy and workshops and panels. So it's, you know, we've got that same dynamic feel to it that we've always had as well.
Awesome. And you kind of got into it there, but I think especially right now, people are really eager to support Canadian content. I was wondering if you could speak to the significance of KCFF being an event that centers Canadian content right now in this cultural moment. And if you've maybe had some conversations about this topic with your team and audiences, creators, et cetera.
Yeah. So, like, again, this is what we've always done for almost 26 years now. So, but it, this year and last, maybe does feel more timely to be an all Canadian film festival, given, you know, everything that's going on in the world. And I think people may be embracing their Canadianness more so than in my early years with the festival. But I not to keep bringing up the pandemic, but I did really notice during the pandemic when we did the live streams and people were able to watch our films from anywhere. A lot of our geo restrictions we didn't actually have geo restrictions for all our films. So we were able to show a lot of our films overseas and then within Canada, like coast to coast to coast. So a lot of people in Vancouver, Halifax, or up north that may not have normally attended the festival in a regular year were able to check out our festival during those years. And it was interesting to hear the way that they would speak about our festival just in our communications with them or on like chats or whatever, or in the Q&As that we did, and like talking about KCFF like it was their festival, you know, like having that sense of ownership. And that was the first time it ever dawned on me that anybody from Vancouver or Halifax or up north would think of our festival in that way. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. And not to like pump our own tires here, but talking with other festival directors from other festivals, maybe a similar size of KCFF in other cities, they didn't really notice that because, you know, they were maybe an international festival. So they didn't necessarily have that audience from far away latching onto their festival for those reasons. So yeah, maybe that's a long way of saying that I've in recent years noticed people from outside of Kingston really embracing what we do and having a sense of pride and ownership of KCFF, even though they don't live here. And, you know, as the festival's grown and we have more tourists coming to the festival and people from out of town, we're now experiencing that in person as well. So yeah, it's kind of cool to see that.
Yeah, for sure. That's really cool. And I was wondering, kind of related to that,
what does it mean to host a national film festival in a city like Kingston, especially as our film industry continues to grow and has a lot of development happening right now?
Yeah, it's really important. I think it helps put Kingston on the map. It's a unique thing. So, you know, we always say we're the globe's largest all-Canadian film festival, which is true, but there aren't really that many that are doing that either. So it is unique in and of itself. And I think, you know, helps set KCFF and Kingston apart. And this is maybe a slightly outdated stat, but I don't think it's changed a whole lot. But it was something like the last stat I heard was 2% of the box office is spent on Canadian films. So when people are going to the Cineplex or Landmark or probably even the Screening Room, although they would do a better job than the commercial theaters for playing Canadian, but it's a very low percentage of films from Canada that are being played in theaters. So, but yeah, a lot of these filmmakers are going overseas, like the Berlin Festival or wherever, major festivals, and winning awards. But yet, right here in Canada, we don't really give Canadian film enough attention. So yeah, I think it just highlights the importance of organization like KCFF playing these films. And then in recent years, you will see more going to Crave. And we used to always say, like, if somebody asked, where can I see these after the festival, we're like, go to Classic Video. And that was always our best answer, and was true. But now, you know, it is more, we'll say, we'll go back to the Screening Room. Sometimes we'll show some of our top films after KCFF. But you can see some on Crave now, and the odd film will go to Netflix as well. But a lot of the films that we show are only going to play on the big screen at KCFF. And so I think it's also a rare opportunity if you like the theatrical experience and what festivals offer, things like Q&As. It's like often the only chance to see these films.
Awesome. And kind of to wrap up this section here, for both seasoned attendees and those attending KCFF for the first time this year, what do you hope folks can take away?
I guess just a greater appreciation of Canadian film and how good it is, and hoping maybe that people don't, because things are starting to sell out. I always say to people, if something sells out, go to your second or third choice at the festival, because we'll often have five or six things playing at the same time. And that'll often be your favorite film that you take away from a festival. That's always my experience too. The film that I try to get into and don't, I'll go to my number two or three pick, and that'll end up being something that I just didn't think that I would like or enjoy. So I guess all to say, like, take a chance on things at the festival that you may not normally go to. You know, we've tried to curate it so that there's like really good docs and comedies and like thrillers and whatever you know, genre that you're into. There's something for everyone, but also, you know, maybe get outside your comfort zone and go to something that you wouldn't like, and you might be surprised. So yeah, that's kind of a message we always tell people at KCFF. And some people come in for events like, you know, we have July Talk playing, or we have K. Trevor Wilson from Letterkenny doing comedy, or we have a workshop component and a whole creative industries day. So if you come in through those arms of the festival, you know, take a chance on something else as well. There's no matter what path of entry you have into the festival, I think there's lots of other things to do once you're there.
Once again, that was Mark Garness, director of the Kingston Canadian Film Festival, on what attendees can expect from this 2026 edition. Council has unanimously approved $3 million in funding for the development of Tricolor Labs, a shared industry-ready wet lab and biomanufacturing facility planned for Botterill Hall at Queen's University. Ben McGillwam with Kingston Economic Development Corporation spoke to the demand for the facility and the benefit of having it in Kingston.
So the primary users of the lab are going to be fully funded commercializing stage life sciences companies looking for lab space, spinouts from the university and the college, and then other regional spinouts looking for BSL2 lab space, and scaling life science companies within the region looking for short-term leases anywhere from 10 weeks to over a year. And then foreign direct investments looking for lab space to enter the North American market, kind of hitting the ground running. Tricolor Labs, addresses a clear market demand across Ontario. There's a lack of wet lab space, especially the BSL2 for companies. And Kingston in particular has a severe lack of this space. The Tricolor Labs will integrate quite well with the Kingston ecosystem, the strengths that are Queen's University, the biotech program that's at St. Lawrence College, and the city's vision for a long-term health campus around a new hospital. This will be a feeder to that space. Kingston has a strong area of research and early stage innovation in the life sciences. We have programs like Dun & Desponsay's Queen's Innovation, a build-to-scale life science program where we see companies spinning out IP from the university into new businesses. Leveraging the research strengths that's at Queen's University and a lot of the equipment that is there that life science companies want.
Jesse Coobs with Economic Development at Queen's University also spoke before council to how Queen's is uniquely positioned to meet this demand for lab space.
Queen's University is uniquely positioned to host Tricolor Labs. It has established programs and offers entrepreneurial and IP support necessary for early stage companies. The campus has established BSL 1 and 2 wet lab infrastructure, specialized equipment, and full biosafety and waste management framework already in place. It also has state-of-the-art animal facilities that help bridge the preclinical gap that often exists for startups. And importantly, Queen leads numerous clinical trials locally and internationally, meaning companies have the ability to plug directly into clinical research pathways as well. The eighth floor of Bottle Hall provides an ideal foundation for Tricolor Labs footprint. It already contains existing BSL 1 and 2 wet lab space, autoclaves, fume hoods, waste systems, all connected by secure card access hallways. The vision is to update and modernize the existing space into flexible modular suites similar to smart labs style facilities that are in global innovation centers, enabling multiple firms to collate safely with direct access to Queen's core facilities. Second floor is another area that's been designated with an open concept layout, growth-friendly space, ideal for companies looking for collaborative and scalable workspace. Shared equipment that is essential that would be cost prohibitive for companies, but it allow companies to grow and collaborate.
McIlwain and Coobs were given another opportunity to highlight the university's unique positioning for this project when asked by council how much this project would cost without the existing infrastructure at Queen's.
So I think the ballpark of that would be around $1,500 a square foot. Just to renovate it was over $1,000 a square foot, plus the planning and permitting, and then finding the space that would fit the needs.
I'll just add quickly, to set up a biosafety level 2 building without the infrastructure would be millions and millions of dollars. The opportunity here is that we'll leverage existing infrastructure that is multi-million dollars of equipment and already established programs that we can leverage.
The funding is conditional on securing and maintaining additional government funding, finalizing governance and oversight structures, and executing formal funding and collaboration agreements between the City of Kingston, Kingston Economic Development Corporation, and Queen's University. The city's contribution will be limited to capital and equipment costs only, with no responsibility for operating, maintenance, or life cycle expenses. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.